You're listening to the End of Sport podcast, a podcast about harm, labor, and inequality in capitalist sport with your hosts, Johanna Mellis, Nathan Coleman-Lamb, and Derek Silva. The End of Sport podcast is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network, your left podcast community. Find us in great company with over 60 other shows at harbingermedianetwork.com. And as always, if you're enjoying the show, please feel free to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform and please leave us a 5-star review, as those always help us reach a wider audience. Thanks for tuning in and enjoy this episode of The End of Sport.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the End of Sport podcast. This is Johanna Mellis speaking, and today we have a pretty, well, unbiased, but a pretty cool episode for you all today. This was an interview that I did with Carly Chardonnay-Webb in August of 2023, so last summer. Basically, Carly wanted to speak to me about Hungary and sports washing. Because at the time I was in Budapest doing research for my book, and also Viktor Orban, Hungary's current prime minister, fascist dictator, he was about to host the World Athletics Championships in Budapest, or had just started. I can't quite remember the timing. But so she had me on, and Carly is a contributor to Outsports and host of the Transition Defense podcast. And so, like I said, she wanted to have me on to kind of talk through Hungary and Orban and sports washing. And so that is very much the context of this episode. Now, even though it was like very contemporary to the time when we did the interview last August, I talk a bit about the history of sports in Hungary and a little bit about my research, but we talked a lot about how and why Orban is trying to use sports, specifically how he's trying to use the hosting of international sports events as a tactic to sports wash. Some might say whitewash, but as Jules Boykoff and others would say, to sports wash, just his really disgusting fascist policies that are going on over there. And so that is what the podcast episode is about. Now, this is more of an evergreen episode because Orban doesn't seem to be going anywhere anytime soon, sadly, for reasons that I discuss in the episode. Now, someone might be wondering why release this episode now in April of 2024. So a bit of backstory. Earlier this year, in like February, I had thought about us wanting to release it, and I actually recorded an intro in February of 2024. So now we're just at 2 months later, and I'm finally sitting down to record another one because so much has happened in Hungary, in Hungarian domestic politics since then. So a few reasons why I wanted to release the episode in early February was because Tucker Carlson had just interviewed Vladimir Putin of Russia on February 8th. And then I recorded this on February 9th, according to my notes. And so the reason why I wanted to talk to listeners about that with respect to Putin is because I have long thought that basically the US and the GOP in particular has only been able to be pro Russia to a certain extent. I mean, there's obviously Trump's connections, but basically because of Trump's connections and also because of the Cold War and our historically anti-communist stance, Americans are really wary of Russia historically. But a place like Hungary, which does not have the same history with the US, and actually Hungary historically shares a lot of things with the US, which I think that I talk about in here. If not, I can talk about it later. I think it shares a lot of similarities with the history of the US South, for example. Obvious difference. But I do think this kind of politics of grievance, as well as the kind of irredentism, nationalism, white supremacy, things like that are very, very similar between Hungary and the US. And so at the time in February, I was thinking, you know, this would be really interesting because Carlson is very, at that point, like really actively platforming Putin. Like that was one of the boldest moves that I could foresee. And I argued at the time that his interview legitimized Putin's war in Ukraine and the genocide going on there. And I was thinking a lot about how the U.S. right continues to develop a tighter relationship with Orban because it might piss a lot of electorates of a lot of constituents off if it were to tighten relations with Russia. Now, Hungary is an important country to study, like every single country. I'm not here to say that it is more important than other countries, but I will say that it's a pretty overlooked country because it is viewed as not being particularly important. It's been invaded a whole bunch of times. But basically my work looks at, and I'm not the only one who does this, but I'm one of the few who does this within sport, Hungary and Hungarian sports people as people representing a small nation have sought to use international sport as a platform to project a bigger nationalist project onto the world stage and has tried to influence international sport in order to best serve domestic political ends. Now, this is not a particularly unique argument per se, but I have kind of unique arguments with respect to Hungary. But I also talk about how it really is successfully influences the IOC in particular. And there are many other, you know, you could look at international soccer or football, you could look at fencing, you could look at aquatic sports, you could look at many different things. And actually in that interview, Carlson actually asked Putin if he believed that Hungary had the right to, quote, take its lands back from Ukraine, because part of Western Ukraine used to be part of the Hungarian kingdom as part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire before and through World War I. Now, Putin kind of like doesn't really answer it. He said something to the effect of, quote, one may say that they could claim back those lands of theirs while having no right to do that. It is at least understandable. So at least legitimizing Hungarians' belief or some Hungarians' belief that they have a claim to those historic lands. It's just really disgusting. And so Hungary sports washing, as I mentioned earlier, plays a big part in this. And that's what the bulk of this episode talks about. Now, the reason why I'm doing a second intro is because, like I said earlier, there have been some pretty massive political developments that had literally just broken that week in February when I first recorded this. And a lot more has happened as a result. And at the time, I was really hopeful that maybe it would have some drastic political changes. Maybe. I don't think that it will, but it is interesting all the same. Essentially, what happened was that news broke that the president of Hungary, as well as, let me look at my notes, the president of Hungary, as whose name was Katalin Novak at the time, as well as the female minister of justice, Judit Varga, news broke that both of them had helped to pardon a guy, I don't remember his exact title, but had pardoned a guy, sorry, an orphanage director who had helped to cover up child sexual abuse from a religious serial child sex predator. And so news broke in early February that this happened. Now this was powerful news to break because Orban has very famously, very similar to the GOP, has very famously pronounced itself the quote-unquote defender of the family, the defender of the Christian family, aka the Christian white family, has said that over and over and over again. He hasn't allowed trans people to exist for a very long time. Very homophobic details that I talk about with more specifics in the interview. So it was really interesting that this came to light. And at the time, in early February, when I initially recorded the intro, she had not resigned. Neither Novak nor Varga had resigned. They've since both resigned. And very soon after, thousands upon thousands, some people quoted upwards of 150,000 people, they gathered in Budapest in a sort of protect the children protest. Now, the protest was really massive. It was not quite an anti-Orban protest, unfortunately, but was really about, you know, trying to at least hold the government accountable for not protecting children in an orphanage from a religious serial child predator. And since then, more developments have happened. Varga's ex-husband, Novak and Varga were really close members of Orban's political party. And Varga's husband, Peter Magyar, ex-husband, he had also been part of the party. And he basically announced that that the government, which is run by Viktor Orban, had interfered in some of Varga's work when she was the Minister of Justice. Now, there's a lot of kind of back and forth. Like the government came out and said that Madyar was basically making stuff up, that he wasn't right, and blah 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 blah. And Varga has also, like, in her first public kind of announcement last week or the week before, she said that Madyar physically assaulted her. Now, people are wondering if Fidesz put her up to this. We don't know. I am someone, as you all know, I take assault against women very, very seriously. So it's hard to know. The thing that sucks is that Orban would definitely use this for his political game, even though he's extremely sexist and misogynist. But he would use it for his own gain as a way to say he's really the father of all Hungarians and he should really protect people. Another thing that came out was that the new president of Hungary, they was appointed to replace Katalin Novak. The new president apparently has Nazi connections, like connections to actual Nazis who benefited from the expropriation of property from Jewish people during the Holocaust in 1944, I believe. So actual literal Nazi connections, which is not a surprise, but also kind of is. And then the last two things I would say is that Madyar has since announced his own political party that he basically wants to provide an alternative to Orban. Some people attended his own kind of protest movement. Who knows what's really going to happen, but a lot of things could be potentially shaken up in Hungary. But honestly, I am not hopeful at this point in early April 2024 that it is going to be enough to wrestle power away from Orban, which is really sad because I wish that this would happen. All of these people that I just mentioned are all current or former members of Orban's political party, Fidesz. And again, really listen to the episode because I go into a lot of detail about how he has entrenched his fascist rule in Hungary. And I call it fascist for very specific reasons, even though a lot of people refuse to call him that. Hungary's links with Tucker Carlson and the GOP, we talk about that at length. So I hope that people find this episode informative. And yeah, please rate, review, and subscribe. Let us know if you have thoughts about it. And I hope you enjoy it. I hope you learn something. Enjoy the show.
Well, first, Doctor, I take it it's good to be back in on home soil for a little bit.
It's great to be back here in the sense that Hungary is like a beautiful country. There's a lot of history here. I always liken it to the U.S. South in a way. I can talk about that more if you want. That's kind of a tangent, but and great to see friends. I have some really lovely friends here, and so in some aspects, it's really great to be here and enmeshed in my research.
What is some of the research you're doing?
Yeah, so stop me if I go on too long. So my research is about sports during the Cold War, and I look at Hungary as a kind of case study because a lot of the histories of sports in the Eastern Bloc focus on the Soviet Union and East Germany, kind of the two main countries that people are familiar with, especially in the U.S. And so I look at Hungary as kind of a different sort of case study because it had some of the world's best athletes in the 1950s that dominated sports like football or soccer, women's gymnastics, swimming, water polo, fencing, modern pentathlon. So I have interviewed a lot of athletes over the years and some sport officials. And right now I'm doing follow-up research for my book, which is expanding the kind of domestic case study to look at Hungarian sports people's interactions with the International Olympic Committee. And I'm arguing that the IOC is a cultural imperial organization. And so what does it look like when there's like a socialist state that's supposedly committed to anti-imperialism? What does it look like when they're working with an imperial body? And so like last week I was in Switzerland looking at some of the materials about colonization that the IOC was putting out, which was very interesting and disturbing. So that's the book project in a nutshell.
And you're talking about exactly quite an era in Hungarian sport, especially that era of the magical Magyars in football in the 1950s that if things could have broken different, could have won a world championship. could have possibly won a World Cup. There's also, I mean, I did read your article. I did read the essay you wrote on the water polo match between Hungary and the Soviet Union.
Aww, where thank there was you for just a lot of
where there, well, I mean, it just seemed, I mean, it was right after the invasion.
Right.
So it's very fascinating. I'm looking forward to see what more comes up from the research, because it's very interesting. Just that whole dichotomy where you're talking about, on one hand, you had state-sponsored sports to be used as PR by the regime, but at the same time, the regime was also saying, okay, if you guys kind of go, if the IOC goes light on us, we'll support, I mean, we're talking the IOC under the leadership of Avery Brundage.
Good old Slavery Avery.
Slavery Avery, Naked Parades Avery. That also fits into a lot of the things that are happening now. For example, there is regulations about trans women in chess now.
So ridiculous and awful.
Yeah, it is absolutely ridiculous. I'm doing a commentary this morning on that, I'm doing my first Carly's commentaries on Substack about that issue. But what are the parallels you're seeing between some of the research you're doing and the situation right now? For example, this year, World Swimming Championships were in Budapest. At the same time, by the way, that World Swimming says, oh, we're going to put the screws to all transgender people. And now they're moving the headquarters from Switzerland to Hungary, and then World Track and Field Championship starting this Sunday. And it's interesting. People, including my own editor-in-chief, Sid Ziegler, who during the World Cup, pointing the finger at Qatar, says, ooh, look, see. But similar type of laws have been passed ever since FIDIS has come to power. Are you seeing some of the parallels between the Cold War period and now and some of the actions that the Hungarian government is taking here?
That's an excellent question. I did a conference paper a long time ago about this. It must have been 2014, because in 2014, the Hungarian government, controlled by Fidesz, Viktor Orban, he'd been back in power for about 4 years, was putting like millions of dollars into building football stadiums, when Hungarian football hasn't been very good since basically the 1960s, 1970s. And so my argument at the time was that the Fidesz government, Orban, was borrowing these communist symbols of power, basically borrowing these ideas of using sport as a form of soft power, or what someone like Jules Boykoff may call like sports washing, right? Using it for sort of sports diplomacy to kind of wash over the image of the human rights violations and, you know, control over free speech and the media and things like that. But at the time, in the mid-2010s, he was really focusing a lot of effort on building up these stadiums that sadly, like, are largely empty at football matches, because the Hungarian football scene just simply isn't very good in the global context. Now, when we're talking about today, what I see kind of one big similarity and one big difference, and that I still think the government is obviously even more invested in sports washing its image and and it's mainly doing this by using the hosting of mega events. Such as the World Aquatics Championships, which it's hosted many times. I can't even count the number of times, many, many times in the last decade. Obviously, hosting the World Athletics Championships, when athletics in Hungary, I don't think, is actually very big of a sport. Like, I don't think track and field sports are very big in Hungary. I could be wrong about that. But really trying to host as many international championships, national championships, or sorry, European championships in Hungary. And it's been doing that for a long time. And so, again, this idea of like using sports as a way to paper over and kind of pull the wool over people's eyes when it comes to, I said, human rights violations, obviously the homophobic, the anti-trans legislation and the rhetoric here is horrible. Orban is very pro-Putin, very pro-Israel. is very like very much a kind of like a, taken a stance against Ukraine and the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And so using sports as a way to kind of paper over some of these things and show the world, or try to show the world and people at home, that Hungary loves sports, that it is like this beautiful kind of lovely country that athletes can come in and kind of compete here and kind of look at how beautiful Budapest is and look how beautiful our country is. And really be able to kind of get away with a lot of these human rights violations, all of the suppression of free speech, attempts to suppress the constitutional court and things like that. Now, one major difference that I'll say, and this is what my research focuses a lot on, is the labor kind of rights and conditions of the athletes under state socialism. So during the Cold War, one of the things that the communists or socialists, whatever you want to call it, their governments, at least in Hungary, really focus on paying athletes for their labor. They paid them for being athletes. Athletes did not have the job title of being an athlete, but athletes sort of got paid in a sort of like indirect fashion that I can go into it if you want me to. Whereas today the government is not really concerned about paying athletes for their labor. They will give athletes like really large sums for winning an Olympic gold medal, for winning a championship, for those sorts of things. But in terms of like athletes' rights and support, as far as I know, the government is not that interested in actually supporting athletes' rights. It's really, and paying and supporting athletes financially and institutionally. I think it's just interested in its sports washing image domestically and internationally. And obviously the fact that FINA, the International Aquatics Federation, is going to be moving here to Budapest really just like blows my mind. I mean, in a way, it sort of fits because aquatic sports in Hungary have been major. I mean, the first Olympic medal that Hungary won was in swimming, either in 1896 at the first Olympic Games or 1900. I can't remember. I think it is in 1896. Water polo is a huge sport. Kayaking and canoeing are huge sports. Sailing are huge sports. So these water sports have been really tied to Hungary's history as a nation and its nationalism. So in a way it sort of fits within the history, but it's definitely an attempt to influence the world of swimming and also to align its homophobic and anti-trans legislation with FINA's, you know, very clear anti-trans law that it passed. I don't remember if it was 2021 or 2022.
Affirmed just this year, even though they're talking about now this open category that they're going to be running it at the Berlin World Cup meet, or at least it'll be demonstrated at the upcoming World Cup meet in October. But there will 8 members of what we term at Outsports Team LGBTQ will be competing at the upcoming World Championships. One of them, American middle distance runner Nikki Hills, identifies as trans and non-binary. Are they safe in Hungary? Are any member of that contingent safe in Hungary?
That's such an excellent question. I think I'll say one thing is obviously everyone has a different definition of what safety means. I think I'll maybe give like an overview before I answer of some of like the laws and legislation, just to kind of paint the landscape. Certainly. For people. And I actually looked up the dates of all,
because especially the most recent law, which is saying we will report citizens who are in safe sex marriage, who are same sex and who are married.
Yeah. So I have a clarification of that because I when I was doing my research for this interview, I kind of found something that I to sort of adjust that. So really like these homophobic laws, well, I should say Hungary has had a queer community like everywhere in the world for a very long time. If somebody is looking for like a really excellent history, there's this book called Queer Budapest that came out a couple years ago by Anita Kuramai, who actually was a tennis player for a long time. She came, was an NCAA athlete in the US. She's based at Bryn Mawr. So if you want to know some of this history, Hungary and Budapest has had, like, I don't want to say a thriving, but a really strong queer community for a long time. So Viktor Orban and his political party, Fidesz, came to power again. They had been in power from 1998 to, I think, 2002, and then they got voted out. They came to power again in a really strong election in 2010. I can go into some reasons about why they came into power, but as soon as they
Give it, because I think a lot of people don't understand this. The part of the reason why I'm writing this column is that, again, the finger is often pointed at, for example, people look at Putin. Yeah. People look at Xi in China. They look at the Middle East. And also now we're talking about there's anti-gay laws in Uganda. This is a member of the European Union.
Right.
They're being sued by the European Union right now over their law. There has been friction in the among the European Union for what amounts to defying codified human rights violations, and they are a member of the NATO alliance. Hungary is a member of NATO. The quote-unquote democratic bulwark of the world, and they are doing the same. People look at the world outside of NATO, the European alliance, the quote-unquote Western democracies, and point their finger. Yeah, the same thing is happening in Hungary, in Italy, in Britain, in Florida, in Texas, and no one bats an eye. So by all means, give the overview.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mentioned that the Fidesz had been voted out of power in the early 2000s, 2001 or 2002, I can't remember. And there was a pretty strong socialist party that got voted in around that time. And the socialist party had connections to the former like communist socialist party of the Cold War era. It was pretty popular from my understanding, and my understanding is a little bit rough, but was pretty popular. And then in 2006, there was a famous speech that was supposed to be kept a secret, but somebody recorded it and released this recording, and it became known as the Lies speech. And basically in this speech, the I believe it was the Prime Minister Ferenc Gyurcsány and the heads of the Socialist Party admitted that they had basically been lying about the state of the economy. And this speech was released, and there were like massive, massive responses to it. There were really massive protests to this. And there was a really, really strong right at that time was a moderate right backlash to what was going on. It was not the hard right that we see now. It was a moderate right. And people on the left were really upset about it, too. And so then there were elections, and I think it was, again, the dates are a little fuzzy, 2009, 2010. And that's when Orban won a really, really massive majority in power now, and his party Fidesz came back into power. Now at the time, Fidesz was a moderate conservative party. It was not like this far right that we see today. There was a much further far right party called Jobbik. And they won, they also won a large percentage of the vote in 2010. Now what happened over the years is that Jobbik moved further to the center, and Orban and Fidesz move further to the right, probably to kind of pander to this kind of supposed vacuum of like far right voters. So over time, since 2010, Orban has moved very, very much to the far right. So that's in 2010 when he gets back into power. And even today, like people say that this like releasing of this recording of the lie speech, that really delegitimized the left. And that is one of the reasons why even today in 2023, you know, 17 years later, the left parties, there are many, many leftist parties. They're very, very split. There's very little cohesion. There are attempts for them to kind of work together and come up with a few kind of common candidates, but every year it kind of ends up being pretty disastrous. So they get into power in 2010. Fidesz immediately starts working on rewriting the constitution. And one of the things that they do is they rewrite it so that the winning party, the party that's going to win, has to have 2/3 of the vote. And this is something that's really prevented the splinter left parties from really being able to gain any ground. I mean, part of it is because of the infighting between them, the lack of unity, the Socialist Party, which still has some support here, just being totally kind of delegitimized after this lie speech in 2006. But also it's this 2/3 majority rule that just really like hampers any party from being able to get voted into power. So 2011,
Let me make sure I understand this right.
Yeah.
For an opposition party to kick Fidesz out of power, they have to win 66% of the vote.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's massive.
In short, right after Orban took power in 2011, one thing I do know is that they basically debased all the democratic institutions. They slowly eroded them. It's what Brent Tannehill calls Calvin Ball.
Mm.
Basically change the rules as you go along.
Yeah.
And make sure that you make a bunch of new rules so that no opposition can, that even if an opposition forms, make it so that they cannot win.
Right, right. Yeah. And there's this legal scholar named Kim Shepley. I can send you the article
Please do.
Yeah. It's a really good article that I was reading before it. And she talks about how, like, part of this new wave of what I would say, she doesn't say the word fascist, but I would say fascist. The part of this new wave of, like, global fascists, both in the US, Russia, all these places you mentioned, is that they're not only are they taking power through, like, elected means, which also Hitler was elected to power too, right? So this is not even a new thing, but that they're going mainly through legal channels, and so they are elected into power, then they are changing the rules of the constitution, or they're changing the laws to better suit their own needs, rather than try to ram it through quite so much kind of force and violence, which we saw a lot of violence in the 1930s, which is, you know, people consider 1930s to be the prior wave of fascism. So it's sort of softened, these fascists have sort of softened their tactics to do it through legal means. So they can do it piecemeal. And so part of this piecemeal process was rewriting the constitution, was clamping down on the media, was something that Orban did very, very quickly after coming to power in 2010, was also increasing his control over the judicial system. He doesn't have total control, and the constitutional court will sometimes push back against him, but most of the time it does not. So 2011, the government bans same-sex marriage. 2012, it banned same-sex couples from adopting children. So even when I was doing the research for today, I didn't quite realize, like, how central homophobia was to his policies and governance immediately. I mean, 2011 banning, you know, gay couples from getting married, 2012 banning them from adopting children. And then in 2020, I know this is leaping ahead a bit, but I remember this during COVID, is when he banned transgender and intersex people from legally changing their gender. And one of the reasons why, I don't remember if it was parliament or the constitutional court, but one of the reasons why they upheld this law was they said that for health and legal matters, that basically legal authorities and medical authorities needed to be able to know, quote unquote, the real gender of people, which is, as we know, is like utter bullshit. So that was 2020. So obviously, like, trying to prevent trans intersex people from existing as they are, right? So that's already like a genocidal tactic. And then 2021, that's when we have what people have called the anti-propaganda law, which really we see a lot of that happening here in the US as well, where they went after like TV shows, book content and things like that supposedly like promoted an unchristian lifestyle, basically, was sort of how it was portrayed. And what they did in 2021 when they did this anti-propaganda law is they attached these elements to an child sexual abuse law, right? Which is the same thing that we're seeing in the US, this idea that like gay people are pedophiles, right? So we need to, by banning, you know, any kind of promotion of their ideology, supposedly, this is what's going to protect our children, right? It's all a ruse. Now, finally, we get to the law you just mentioned, the 2023 law, which people have called the whistleblower law. Now, this is like a much broader law about dealing with like whistleblowers in general. Now, the initial version of the law had a clause in it, or had an amendment to it, that allowed, as you said, that allowed citizens to report on report on gay families, report on families where the parents were gay, since that is against the law here. Now, what I found out when I was doing research today is actually the final version of the law passed in May did not include that clause, which is actually kind of surprising to me. The president, who is a woman, not that that really matters when it comes to homophobia and transphobia, right? She vetoed that portion of the law, which was actually like a pretty hard stance against Orban, which I found really surprising. But most of like the Western reporting about this whistleblower law only like basically did not update the fact that that clause was not included. But still, you know, you have all of these other laws, right? Just because this like, you know, reporting on, you know, families with gay people in it, just because that clause didn't get passed, it still doesn't mean that it's a safe place to be. And I think that finally gets to your question about, is this a safe place to be for queer, trans, non-binary, and other kinds of people that identify under the LGBTQIA umbrella? I would say no, because on the one hand, if an athlete is like, simply just like hanging out at the World Athletics Championships, is anybody going to say anything to them, or is anything going to happen to them? Obviously, hopefully not. Lots of different people are going to be there. It's going to be a very quote unquote diverse environment, because it's going to have athletes and spectators and reporters and coaches from all over the world. But my fear is that as soon as they step outside of that, what is it going to be? And honestly, the reason why I say that is because this is something I've been tweeting about, because it hasn't really gotten the attention of the Western press, is that a couple weeks ago in this smaller town called Gurulu, I'll send you the tweets about it that spells the name of the town. There were two athletes, track and field athletes from India, who were walking around and taking pictures. And there were a couple, they were like nearby a playground. And the two athletes were looking at their phones, and there were some parents at the playground, if I'm understanding this correctly, who thought that these athletes were migrants. And something I did not mention earlier is that Orban is incredibly racist, incredibly anti-Semitic, incredibly anti-Black.
Absolutely. We heard that at CPAC.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Yeah. I haven't even brought it back to CPAC yet. Right. So, and he's very anti-migrant is kind of how he portrays himself as we are going to protect Christian values, which means white Christian values. Now there's a bit of nuance to that that I'll get to in a second, but in 2015, during the so-called like migrant crisis after the Arab Spring, when there were a lot of people from North Africa and the Middle East that were fleeing violence there, that was largely, yes, you know, influenced by Western colonialism. They were fleeing Middle East, North Africa, and trying to get to Western Europe. So Orban really, politicized and used, the quote unquote migrant crisis for his political propaganda, and came out very strongly against, migrants from these areas. So that anti-migrant sentiment is very, very strong in a lot of people's minds here. And so what happened is this these families saw these two Indian athletes and thought they were migrants. And so there are different reportings about, like, did they call the police? Did these parents like threaten to beat them up? It's not like, again, it's not totally clear, but what is clear is that these families chose to feel threatened by these two Indian athletes. And there's a picture in this tweet that I'll send you, and they're literally just like looking at their phone. Like, it's very clear that one of them is showing something to the other person on his phone, because they're both leaning over it. They're not taking pictures. They're not getting close to anybody at the playground, like literally just two people walking around being tourists, just doing their thing. And there's this incident of racism. And so that's where, and yes, they were not in Budapest. They were outside of the city. Budapest is known for being a much more left-leaning and open city than elsewhere in Hungary. But I guess I don't want to give anybody like false hope that these athletes, if they step outside of the arena, if they step outside of the racing, you know, course, all this stuff, that they're going to be safe. And also, even though there's like a really strong pride parade here every year, a pride parade that I've participated in a lot over the years. There are police that like surround the route for Pride. So, which I know police at Pride is like a really problematic thing. It does prevent far right protesters from seeping in too far, because they set up the barricades pretty far away and in a lot of cases from the parade route. But yeah, so I think I'm scared for athletes of color. I'm scared for queer athletes. And I guess like my suggestion would just to be like very, very careful. Maybe wear your athletic gear everywhere you go, which sucks because they should be able to just wear whatever they want. Right. But I guess I would hope that if, homophobic Hungarians were to see them walking around and see them in athletic gear, maybe they would associate them with the event. Not that that's a good thing, right? Again, they should be able to wear whatever they want to wear, but I guess that's kind of my suggestion. And also to like walk around in a group. Now I'll say like, I feel very safe here, but I'm also not queer. You know, I'm also not a person of color. So my experience here is very different. So yeah, that's a very long-winded answer to your question.
What's the general mood? Being back in Hungary, having friends who live in the country, yeah, and as a person who, and you attend Pride, chances are some of those people are LGBTQ people.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is the general mood in Hungary?
Yeah. That's a great question. I mean, my friends are all like left-leaning. So like, I guess I'll give that caveat. Typically if you attend a Pride parade, you're left-leaning. Obviously there are like right-leaning people who support Pride, ideas, but, I think it's pretty, somber. It's pretty, people are frustrated. People are saddened by the state of affairs. The economy is doing really poorly right now. I think the Central Statistics Office, I think it's that office, just reported that the economy here shrank by like 2.3% in the last quarter. The EU has frozen a lot of the funds that it would otherwise be giving to Hungary due to these laws and the constitution and things like that. The EU has finally like taken a stance against Hungary and saying, okay, like you are violating a lot of our principles that you are supposed to be agreeing to and be in compliance with. So we are going to be freezing your funds. And EU funds has really buoyed the economy over the years. I mean, the Hungarian economy is not very strong, but it's really buoyed the economy here. It's EU funds is part of what's made the city like clean up a lot of its buildings and do a lot of the reconstruction that has helped make Budapest really beautiful. Budapest has always been beautiful, but like a lot of the buildings are really dirty in need of repair and things like that after the Cold War. So I think people are really somber. I think a lot of my friends are not particularly like quote unquote political. They go and vote during elections, but I think they feel like the political situation is pretty hopeless. And then a lot of them, I don't want to say they're strapped financially because I don't want to speak to their financial conditions, but they feel that there are not that many opportunities for them here to have like a successful, thriving life here. And there, a lot of them are just like really, really disgusted at the homophobia. I mean, transphobia is like, I don't want to say ubiquitous in Hungary, but like in the US, there's a much stronger contingent of people that are strongly pro-trans. In Hungary, that's a much smaller group of people. But a lot of people do actually accept gay people. They accept them and kind of want them to live their lives. So a lot of people really upset about that. And a lot of people are really upset at like, why is the government spending all this money hosting athletics events? I mean, that's millions of what would be dollars or forints in the Hungarian currency. I mean, probably billions of Hungarian forints that could be spent on the school system, healthcare system, all of these kind of basic supports. The last thing that I'll say, and I know I'm getting really long-winded in this answer, is that the government just passed what is called the status law, which is an educational law. And the status law sparked massive protests, which was really like heartening to see. I didn't really do all that much, but it, you know, at least people like went out in the streets and stuff. And part of what this law did was to keep teachers in their positions and keep them in low paying positions and basically prevent them from leaving their jobs. Because actually similar to what we see going on in the US and places like Florida, where we have massive teaching shortages. The Hungarian education system for a long time has had really low salaries for teachers, had really poor teaching conditions. The government's been trying to like control the textbooks that teachers are teaching, not quite doing the same things like Florida and Texas are doing. I think Florida and Texas has taken a much stronger stance than what Hungary has done, but still the Hungarian government still wants to influence how what teachers are teaching in the classroom. But part of the status law, what it does is it makes it so that if a school needs a teacher within the same district, if a school within a district needs a teacher, that school can simply call another school and ask that school if they have a spare teacher, and that teacher has to move to the other school, right? So basically, the government is controlling where people are supposed to teach. And this is something that really pisses a lot of people off, because it means that people might have really long commute times. It means if someone is doing something that the government or their principal or whomever deems to be like inappropriate, right, then the government can actually have a hand in what happens to them. The other thing is it lengthened the amount of the school day and made it so the teachers have more work for little pay. It also made it so that if a teacher wants to leave their job, they have to give their school 6 months notice before leaving, which is wild, because in the US it's like a 2 week thing, right? You know, you give 2 weeks notice.
Six months.
Yeah. So like people really have to plan, like they really, really have to plan. So again, I think the whole goal is to keep teachers in their low paying jobs. And most of the teachers are women. So that sparked a ton of protests, which again, like I said, was heartening to see people responding to it and actually, doing something about it. But a lot of my friends are really upset about, you know, are there going to be enough teachers for the school year, which is going to be starting in September? How many students are going to be in the classroom? What kind of education is my child going to receive? And I mean, even hearing this from people who in the past would have told me openly, you know, I don't really care about politics. Like there are things that Orban does that I don't really like, but like all I do is vote. And like people are really pissed off. So I think, yeah, I think the kind of confluence of all of this stuff is just really frustrated a lot of people. Sadly, the like homophobic and the transphobic stuff is not something that is going to spark a lot of backlash from people. A lot of people are in agreement with those policies. But I would just say, yeah, the overall mood here is like pretty somber. And people are just like a lot of people on the left are just continuing to be disengaged from the political sphere because they just feel like there's no hope for them. And then the last thing I'll say, which I always find kind of interesting and sad, is that like a lot of my friends really look to the US as like a place where like, you know, things might be bad here, but at least there's like this major power in the world that where things are a lot better there. Like people have more freedoms, which is true. But as we know, in the US, a lot of people don't actually have freedoms, right? But like people in other countries have a very idealized kind of Hollywood view of the US. But a couple of my friends have said, you know, it's really sad to see what's happening in the US, because it's clear that what's happening in the US, they're really influenced by Hungary and Orban. And it's really sad, A, to think that Orban has that much power in the international sphere, that he has that much kind of influence. And also it's really sad to see a country that they really, quote unquote, look up to, be really oppressive and be really harmful towards people. So, that's been, I say interesting. That's been like really insightful to me, is that they too feel like saddened by what's going on in the US, and that also kind of shapes their view on what's going on here.
Now, reading some of the articles recently in this run to the World Championships, there is talk of 2036 Summer Olympics, Paralympics, Budapest.
Oh, I didn't know that.
The sport and culture representatives in the Orban government have stated that Hungary will make a bid on 2036. If things if things remain as they are, and based on how much, and based on now that it's taken on a competitive authoritarianist character, it will. What message would it send to have, say, 2036 be in Budapest? Or 2036, another city that's looking at it is Milan, 2036. Assuming the Meloni government stays in power in Italy, which they're doing very similar things as far as debasing democratic institutions. What message would that send about the European Union and NATO for these countries to have these events?
I mean, I think it's going to further disillusion people, like cause further disillusionment in the EU and NATO. I think people have this idea, whether it's correct or not. I mean, the EU is a very problematic institution. NATO is a very problematic institution. A lot of them like reinforce harmful, like historical colonialist trends to them. But I do think people generally think well of the EU in particular as being this bastion of democracy, as you mentioned earlier. So I think it will, I think, you know, a place like Budapest and a country like Hungary hosting the 2036 Olympic Games and Paralympic Games, I think it would, for people who are critical of Hungary, I think it would further disillusion them in the EU as like a genuinely democratic political organization and project. I think beyond, for people who don't care about the EU and NATO or just, yeah, don't really have thoughts about them. I mean, I think, how do I say, I think sports washing internationally is very effective. And this is not based on a study that I've done. I think that it does convince people in a lot of ways that like, oh, these countries are not that bad. I mean, I think like a place like China and Russia, I think is a little bit less successful because the anti-Russian and kind of anti-Chinese sentiment internationally, I think is a bit stronger. But I think for people that don't know that much about Italy, don't know that much about Hungary, and don't know the two countries' really strong histories of authoritarianism and fascism in particular, I think they would see it like Hungary, like, oh, wow, like Hungary used to be communist. And look at now, it's hosting the Olympic Games. I think so. For people who are not that informed about the place, I think it could present a really positive image of Hungary. And I think Italy too, because I think people in the know about Italy know about this really awful government, but I think a lot of people don't know that much about contemporary Italian politics. So I think that's kind of one of the issues. The other thing that I'll say, and you didn't ask about this, but, I don't know if a bid would be successful. I mean, there are a lot of reasons why not might not be successful at the IOC level, but Budapest put up a strong bid to host the 2024 Olympic Games, and they retracted it because there was such strong resistance to it in Budapest. So that is something, even though 2036, even though, you know, the bidding process is like a ways away and the decision-making process is a ways away, I'm hopeful that there will be a similar movement in Budapest to resist the bid so that the bid gets withdrawn, because that would just be so much money, too much money that Hungary doesn't have. I mean, and financially, I'm surprised they even would think about putting up a bid, because the economy isn't such the shitter right now. But then again, who knows how much money they paid for FINA to come here. So that's my assumption, that there's a lot of corruption involved in FINA.
There is a lot of money involved and a lot of give backs to Absalom to get World Athletics to move. Sport. There's talk now, there's the tax relief scheme that came out a couple of years ago in Hungary, 150 million forints to bid for sporting events. And that was just back in 2021. Now, one thing, you host a podcast that talks about a lot of these issues. Mm-hmm. You co-host a podcast that talks about a lot of this. And I mean, I've been on your podcast. Would love to return. Mm-hmm. What in your mind, being that you look at sport, that you look at sports through an anti-capitalist lens, why does sport washing work? Why is it so effective in the internet age? Even it's always been effective throughout, ever since we've had organized sport. I mean, Hitler legitimized Nazism by hosting an Olympic Games. Forward. You've had despotic regimes decide, you know what, if I can host this big spectacle for the rich West, for the rich white West, things like Rumble in the Jungle, good example. Mobutu Sese Seko bankrupt his country to have a heavyweight championship fight in Zaire. Why does sports washing, and now even in the internet era, two questions. One, why is sport washing still so effective in your view? And secondly, how has Viktor Orban become a man whose face is on posters of conservative bedrooms in the United States? How is this
conservative
happening?
Conservative bedrooms. Oh my God.
No, terrible, I know people who love, no, there are young conservative, there are young conservative kids who have posters of Orban in their bedroom. People love, you'd be surprised the number of people who couldn't find Hungary on the map, but they love Viktor, but it seems American conservatives love this man.
Yeah. Ooh, big questions. Okay, let's start with the first one. Why is sports washing so effective in the digital age? I don't know if I have a good answer for this. I think in the digital age, and I think like authoritarian leaders, and I don't just mean like authoritarian leaders like in Hungary or Russia, I even mean, you know, like white supremacists, you know, city council members in LA, right? Like, but there's a lot going on with the LA Olympic Games. And I want to be clear, like sports washing happens in a lot of democratic countries as well. I don't consider Hungary a democracy, but I think it absolutely happens in democratic countries as well.
I mean, sport washing happens from Western institutions. Western institutions, right. A good example of this, a very Western capitalist institution, Formula One. They just released their 2024 calendar, 24 events next year, 14 are in places that have significant levels of legalized discrimination against LGBTQ people.
Yeah.
How does this work so well? To where even these Western institutions are more than happy to put Olympic Games in China, these events in Hungary.
Yeah. So I think, how do I say? I was thinking, so I want to plug this really great article by Jules Boykoff on sports washing. Because he does some really, really great definitions and he does really good analysis of it. And I reread it in preparation for this interview because it'd been a couple months. I honestly think one of the reasons why sports washing is so effective is because international sport organizations are set up for sports washing. And I say that because I haven't written this chapter yet, but going to the IOC archives in Lausanne, Switzerland last week, one of the reasons why I went there, as I was talking to you before, was to look at the language that the IOC used when it talked about wanting to, quote unquote, spread the Olympic movement all over the world. Because I'd read a couple other scholarly articles that brought up some really like troubling, obviously racist, sexist, et cetera, but like colonialist language in some of the IOC's documents. And so I went there wanting to find more material about this. Like, is it just a couple random mentions? It's not a couple random mentions. In the 1920s, for example, before Coubertin resigned in 1925, Pierre de Coubertin was the founder of the Olympic movement and was a president for a long time. He legitimately developed a program to, quote unquote, conquer Africa for the Olympic movement. This idea that there are these, and he talks about dark Africa. He brings up all this awful language, but very specifically colonialist language of like, we are going to conquer the world. We already have what was called the Far East Asia Games. We already have the Latin America Games. Right now, the main place where we do not have the Olympic Games, where Olympic sports are not like the epitome of international sport, is Africa. And literally there are like pamphlets calling for the conquest of Africa using the word conquest in French, and that the IOC translated the word, like the French word for conquest, into conquest in English. And I bring this up because I think that shows, I mean, obviously we know that the Olympic Games are about nationalism. Like, we know that they are about politics fundamentally. But I think what it's about is the IOC wanted to conquer places around the world for the Olympic movement and ensure that its versions of sport and rules and regulations and culture, that those were the epogee of competitive sport, so that they could sort of downplay indigenous local physical activity and sports traditions and ensure that swimming, you know, eventually basketball, soccer, you know, all these sports, horseback riding, all these sports, that those were like the most competitive sports that had the most money and things like that, most prestige. So I think that made it so that it made it very easy for nations to use the Olympic Games for sports washing. Obviously, nationalism plays a big part in this. But again, this idea of like cultural imperialism, I think, makes it so that everybody is complicit. Like everybody from the beginning of the modern Olympic movement in the 1890s, everybody is involved in some way. I mean, and I don't hold the athletes accountable because I think they're a totally different category, but all of the nations and the sports officials and the IOC representatives for the member nations, the IOC representatives for the member nations often have like some connection with the national sport organizations, with sometimes with the government and things like that. And so I just think it's made it very easy over the last century plus for nations to use the Olympic Games to sports wash. And also, as the Olympic Games get more and more expensive, right? It is mainly authoritarian leaders and or oppressive states, like structurally oppressive states, that see the Olympic Games as something that's worth spending money on, that's worth the massive amounts of corruption that they're okay with, right? That's worth spending money on to the detriment of their own people, because they're not actually interested in providing services for their own people, but it's worth it for this international sports washing, also domestic sports washing, to kind of downplay human rights violations, continue to eliminate, try to eliminate the existence of trans people, to eliminate unhoused people from cities, to increase security, increase police, again, police violence against Black and brown people and working class people. So I think in the digital age, I just think the digital aspect of it just ramps up even more. So it's not that it's anything drastically different. It just has ramped it up to another level.
Now,
should I go ahead?
That gets into, in many ways, the exit question. Mm-hmm. Because you just made the point. As the Olympics get more expensive, mm-hmm. are we seeing the end of days with all this in regards to sport as this capitalist enterprise? Are we seeing the revelations moment in this? Because the fact is, one, who can afford to host an Olympic Games, for example? And LA just got, and half the city wants to give it back. We've had one American, there is precedent, an American city did give the Olympic Games back. Remember, Denver had the Winter Olympics in 76, Richard Lamb gave them back. I mean, we're getting to the point where, in many ways, large cities do not want this. Paris really doesn't want it. Brisbane wants it, but why would you put Brisbane would not even get a hearing for an Olympic Games 30 years ago. Atlanta really shouldn't have gotten a hearing for 96. Mm-hmm. Who will host 2030? Who will host 2036? Who will host 2040? Are we seeing in many ways an end game here?
You know, a few years ago, I might have said yes. A few years ago, I would have said there's only a handful of, I say state governments. We know that, right, that bids are, the cities are the ones that bid on the Olympic Games, but a lot of them are supported by like a national government. A few years ago, I would have said, well, there's Russia and there's China and there's a couple countries that are willing to do this and willing to like, are so eager to sports wash their image that they are going to put up this money. But now fascism's on the rise. Like, it's ascending. I could see, for example, like Miami putting up a bid. I mean, Miami, I've never heard of that being suggested, but I honestly would not be surprised, because there's a really strong, like, that's a strong Cuban DeSantis stronghold there. I wouldn't be surprised if that people were talking about that.
That's assuming by the time Miami hosts an Olympic Games, there still is a Miami. There is the elephant that sports isn't talking about. It's called climate change. Yeah, I see this happen. I see this happening. Like, remember I told you on your podcast when I made the appearance there? You could be turning on your computer or whatever televisions look like in 2060 and say, good evening and welcome to NBC's coverage of the 2060 Summer Olympics. We're back here in Anchorage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. The climate element, kind of throws a wrench in all this. I mean, I guess maybe we'll just talk about the bidding process, right? So the bidding process. So I just fear that people, that these like rulers, like, I didn't know about Milan, for example. That's really interesting. I mean, obviously sad. I think there are a lot of political leaders that are very successfully gaining power and therefore are going to view the hosting of the Olympic Games as something that's worth it, to the detriment of their own people, to the detriment of the athletes who go there. And I think, you know, the safety of the athletes we've talked about, but what should athletes be doing is kind of a whole other question. I tweeted about this yesterday. I think the Olympics need to be done away with and something else needs to be created. And I say something else should be created because I know there are athletes that are training and whose livelihoods and dreams are on the line if we say, let's abolish the Olympic Games. So I do think like recreating something for them that they should be creating is important. Like, I think it needs to be like athlete centered, environmentally, centered, working class centered, things like that. But in terms of like, I mean, they're not viable. Hosting the Olympic Games is not a viable thing, in my opinion. I think it hasn't been for maybe ever. People don't really want to have that conversation, but I just think with global fascism on the rise and obviously like white supremacy, the backlash of 2020, I just think more and more people are going to be finding it as something that's worthwhile. Maybe that's really pessimistic of me. Then you bring in the climate change issue and that kind of throws a wrench in it.
Before we go though, I want to get a quick take from you on something that's away from this particular subject, but it's something people will be talking about. Because you had a tweet on it. In fact, the End of Sports podcast episode 120 talked about it. First you guys just had to mention my alma mater and the sad state there and the sad state of affairs at Northwestern, which has a lot of especially Black alums wondering if they should come to homecoming this year, given that the homecoming opponent is Howard. There's a lot of talk of people not, there's a lot of talk about, I'm one of those alums. My 30 year reunion is this year. And I'm having second thoughts about attending because of the situation that's happening there, but also the alignment. We are now seeing a coast to coast super conference being built. Mm-hmm. And I'm definitely going to listen to the podcast, but just a quick take, what's your thoughts on all of a sudden what you've seen? You've seen a conference completely destroyed now. The Pac-12 has been completely destroyed by this. And you have now, imagine being a softball player for Washington. And you got to take that Rutgers, Maryland trip, or a swimmer, or someone who's not in the two, or not in the two sports, quote unquote, people care about. What's your thoughts on what you're seeing in the college sports landscape now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think it's awful. I think this realignment, and I don't really pay attention to like conferences and stuff like that. But I just think about the athletes and how much travel they're going to be doing, how much more class they're going to be missing, the toll on their bodies from like lack of sleep, right? And then how all of this is going to impact their mental health. And, you know, so I'm like wondering, like, what are the athletes at these schools thinking right now? Because I mean, there's so much talk on campuses about mental health awareness and all this stuff. And there's a lot more talk within athletic departments about it. I mean, even at my school, there's a lot more talk about it than there used to be amongst, with respect to athletes, but obviously all students in general. So I feel badly for them. I have a lot of empathy for students because I think this is just going to be like disastrous on many, many levels. And like, for what? For competition, for money that they're not going to get? You know, because I mean, obviously the athletes in quote unquote non-revenue sports, you know, whether they're making money for their school or not depends on the sport and all these different conditions, but they're also performing athletic labor and they are not getting paid for their labor, even if like they're in a non-revenue sport. I guess what I'm hopeful that athletes are going to, if they don't already know it, they're going to realize how hard this is going to be for them, how much this is going to demand of them. And I'm like hopeful that maybe they'll say something about it, right? Maybe they'll say like, there's no way I can actually have an athletic and an academic career and pursue the degree that I want to have. And whether it's, you know, speaking up within their own schools, whether it's actively speaking up on social media, maybe it's retiring from sports. I could see recruits looking at the situation in a year or two, maybe they're looking at it now and being like, you know what? I don't want to be traveling all around the country. And I bet parents are thinking the same thing. So I think it'll be interesting kind of how it shakes out. And I hope that prospective athletes are really thinking about it. And I think they're also thinking about it with respect to what's going on in Florida, Texas, North Carolina, all these states where things are getting increasingly unsafe for people. And I really hope athletes are like trying to make decisions that are going to be the healthiest for them about where they go.
Well, Joanna, thank you for taking away a piece of your research trip vacation for this interview. I really appreciate it very, very much.
Yeah, totally my pleasure to talk to you again, Carly. You are like whip smart. So anytime I talk to you, I learn so much. You're so brilliant.
That's a lot of praise coming from a PhD.
No, you teach me so much every time, like your recall of facts and like your geopolitical analysis. I'm like, damn, I need to do more homework because you're more adaptive than I am. So this is such a pleasure. Thank you so much.